and I would like to ask you to please help me welcome our speaker, Leslie Kay from Fresno. No? I'm sorry. Modesto.
Hi. Hi, everybody. My name's Leslie, and I am from Modesto, California, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Lee for inviting me. It's been a while since I've been in this meeting, and it has grown. And I suppose I should always start off by just sort of qualifying myself really quick. I do have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is May 4th, 1992, and that means that my last one, I celebrated 33 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I am incredibly amazed at. I'm amazed at it. It is not the longest amount of sobriety in this room. I know that. But it's the longest I've ever been sober. And I'm going to tell the people that have picked up Chip's medallion. I love that medallion stallion. We call our guy the chipmunk. I think he's going to like medallion stallion better. I'm going to suggest it. But I have some good news for you, because this is what's happened for me. I have been sober longer than I drank. And that's the good news about Alcoholics Anonymous. That is possible. If I can do it, you can do it. I've been sober longer than I drank. Now, the bad news is I've been sober longer than I drank. So that means that every stupid thing I've done in the last 33 years, I did it stone cold sober. And I cannot say I was drunk when, you know, as an excuse for choosing bad behavior or unprincipled actions or doing something that was just flat out dumb. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot the last couple of months about what I'm supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I have wonderful examples in this program. I have an amazing sponsor that leaves me in the dust when it comes to the basics. And the basics is, of course, you know, have a sobriety date, know what it is. Have a home group. My home group is the principal study group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet once a week. We have one meeting. We are a closed meeting of AA. We are a step, tradition, and concept meeting. So we're a three legacy meeting. We study the steps, we study the traditions, and we study the concepts. I have a sponsor, as I said. I have a home group. I have a sobriety date. I'm in service. I'm in service with my secondary home group, which is the Cheers group of AA. I'm in service at my home group. I'm in service for my district. So I have those things in place. But I have been pondering the last couple of months in particular about what I'm supposed to be really doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't mean in terms of a service commitment. I mean, what is my primary purpose? How do I live these three legacies that have been handed to me? And that has had me doing a lot of inventory work, a lot of prayer, because I will tell you that one of the things I get concerned about is that I hear some really good stuff in the meetings I attend. So I hear some good advice about life in general, okay? I hear some really interesting ideas that they are handing to the new people. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Don't drink between meetings. You know, I hear all of that. And one of the things I've become very aware of is that none of those things are the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. They may be really, really good things to say, but they're not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have seen, as I'm sure Lee is probably saying, and others that have been sober as long as we have or longer, we have seen a lot of changes in Alcoholics Anonymous over the last couple of decades. And some of those changes are really good changes, and others, I'm not so sure. And in Modesto, if we have somebody in the room at an open, and we're in an open meeting, if there's somebody in the room that has less than 30 days, it's the custom for a lot of the meetings in Modesto to read a portion of chapter 3 out of our big book. And that chapter has a line in it where it talks about, I'm going to paraphrase it, but it says, no one likes to admit they are bodily and mentally different from their fellows. And I don't hear a lot of that shared in the meetings of AA anymore. At the State Line Conference this last December, one of the speakers shared that there are close to 300 different 12-step groups registered in the United States. I can guarantee you that I qualify for a whole bunch of them, right? But I am bodily and different, bodily and mentally different from about 85 to 90% of the people in the United States. I am bodily and mentally the same as a lot of you that are here tonight. Not all of you, because there were some Al-Anons that raised their hand. But I am bodily and mentally different. And so even though I may qualify for a whole bunch of different 12-step programs, I identify as an alcoholic. And so when I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am coming to my treatment program. This is my treatment program. Those 12 steps, those 12 traditions, and you don't have them up here, but those 12 concepts. Those, all three of those legacies are my treatment program for my alcoholism. And how do I know I'm an alcoholic? Well, you know, when I got here, I didn't know. I didn't know when I got here. Now, look, everybody around me knew. So I'm not claiming that I'm the brightest bulb in the box, okay? I mean, it's rare that someone is going to say to you, you know what, you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous if they don't think you belong here, okay? I mean, sometimes you'll get sent here. You might get one DUI, and those pesky judges say things like, you need to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're not an alcoholic. You just had a bad night, right? You got caught. I walked into the back doors of the Concord Fellowship around 1989-1990. I'm pretty sure, I can't tell you exactly when it was. There were Christmas decorations on the table, but it was the Concord Fellowship, so, you know, it could have been June, all right? It's and what I heard in the meetings of AA there, and I'm not going to tell you it's what they were saying, but this is what I heard. Put the plug in the jug, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, don't drink between meetings, and you're going to be just fine. And I kept trying to do that. And I would put the plug in the jug, and I would start going to meetings. Look at me, I'm going to meetings, 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 meetings. I'd go to 3-4 meetings a day. I'd go to meetings in the morning. I'd go to work. I'd go to meetings at noon. I'd go to work. I'd go to meetings at 5. I'd go to, well, over here, back and forth, meetings, meetings, meetings. And sometimes I could get 3 whole weeks of continuous sobriety. And then something would happen, and I would get struck drunk. And I didn't mean to drink. I didn't plan on getting drunk. I had sober blackouts. I can remember sitting in my mother's living room in her little house in Pleasant Hill, California, and thinking to myself, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm just fine. I haven't had a drink for 2 weeks. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be fine. The meeting starts at 6. I just have to make it to the meeting. I'm going to be fine. And my next memory of that night is standing in front of a bar at a little Italian restaurant that's still there. It's right down the street from where we used to live. And I was on my second shot of JD. And I knew it was my second shot because there was my change was on the bar. And I can remember thinking, oh, what the hell, I'll just go back tomorrow. I'll just go back again tomorrow. So really the only thing I did right during the next 2 years was I kept coming back. That was it. And I don't ever remember anybody saying to me, there's a real good chance that the reason you can't stay sober simply by putting the plug in the jug and going to as many meetings as you can go to and not drinking between those meetings is because you're an alcoholic. And let me tell you what an alcoholic is. Let me show you what an alcoholic is as it's described in our book. I am one of those annoying old timers that refuses to say that our program is in the first 164 pages of the big book. Because if I say that, you are going to miss what I think is one of the most important chapters in the book, and that is the doctor's opinion. Yes. And see, in the doctor's opinion of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes me. But nobody ever told me about that. At least I didn't hear them say it. And I want to make that really clear. What happened for me was that a mean old alcoholic man, you know the kind, they sit in meetings, they've been sober 300-400 years, they're usually like, you know, at the side, get a book, get a sponsor, you know those ones? Oh, right? This mean old alcoholic man got tired of me, and he yelled at me in a meeting. Now, again, that's what I remember. I remember being yelled at. I have since been told many times that this guy was on oxygen because he was dying of emphysema and it was physically impossible for him to yell. But I remember yelling, he's dead, I'm here, so it's my story, okay? And what I remember is him yelling at me, aren't you tired of always saying you're in your first 30 days of sobriety? I'm tired of listening to you say it. Oh my God, I mean, how rude. And what popped out of my mouth was the only thing I had learned in almost 2 years in AA. You're supposed to love me until I could love myself. And he said, I don't love you. Because I don't even like you anymore. He says, you've been coming in here for 2 years. Whine, whine, whine. He says, you whine about your dead husband. You whine about your dead baby. He says, you whine about your parents getting divorced when you were six. He says, when are you going to come in here and say, I want to quit drinking and I don't know how. Somebody help me. He made me so mad that I spent the next about 60 days going to every meeting I could find him at and staying sober right at him, right? Seriously, I would pull up outside of a meeting place and I'd go, is Eddie here? They go, yeah, he's inside. Good, park the car, and I'd go in and I'd just sit right opposite him like this. And I was so angry that the anger took me through about a little over 60 days of continuous sobriety, and I started picking up chips. Right? I couldn't get chips before. I used to try to get chips. Sometimes I would try to pick up a chip drunk. I would like get up and I'd start walking up towards the front and they'd wait until I was about right where that is and then they'd go, sit down, you're drinking. Oh, and I'd go back. But I finally could get him. I would get a chip and I'd run up to him and I'd say, I got a chip. And he'd say, you know, we give those to anybody. Oh my God. He was so mean. What happened for me is that at about 60, like I said, it was around 60, maybe 62 days sober, I wanted to die. Now, I had never wanted to die when I was drinking. I hear people saying all the time, I was drinking and I wanted to die. Not me. When I was drinking, I was fine. When I was drinking, I was fine. Other people might want to kill me, and you guys might have a problem, but I was fine. But I'm not drinking. And stoplights are taking forever to change. And colors are too bright. And sounds are too loud. And you people, oh my God, you people. I would show up at meetings and you're there with your bright little AA eyes and your big little AA smiles and you're saying stupid things like, how you doing? How you feeling? What are you doing? And it's like, oh God, it was horrible. And that particular night, what I decided I was going to do was I was going to drive my car. I drove a 1987 Chevy Impala, rusty roof, a bad hole in the muffler. It was wonderful. I was going to drive it up the front stairs of the Concord Fellowship into the Concord Fellowship and just take out as many of you as I possibly can. I wanted to go up in a big ball of flame. I wanted to be on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. I wanted the news people standing outside my mother's house talking to the neighbors. I don't understand. She seemed like a nice little girl when she was growing up. We don't know what happened. I wanted all of that because I couldn't take it anymore. I could not stand being sober anymore. And you people, with your stupid little slogans, one day at a time. I knew you meant forever. Who were you kidding? And if you thought I was going to feel like this one day at a time for the rest of my life, So I was going to die. And some of you were going to die. And that was just the way it was. And for whatever reason, I couldn't turn the car around the corner fast enough. So I just got out and walked in. And God put my first AA sponsor into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And it was a man by the name of Cajun Kenny. And Kenny had been sober for 4 or 5 years, and he had sobered up in the Louisiana State Penitentiary in Angola, and he was not real impressed with the sorority girl gone bad. And Kenny is in my life today. He is still a part of my sponsorship family, my greater sponsorship family. I had the privilege in November of this last year of speaking at a conference in Pleasant Hill, and my present sponsor was my timer, and my first sponsor was in the front row. I mean, that's how connected I still am to these people. And he walked up to me, he said, "What is wrong with you?" And I told him, "I can't take this anymore. It's one day at a time. I'm with this. I'm trying to do this. I don't understand. I want to die." And he was like, "Whoa, come with me." And he took me outside and he pulled out a cassette tape. Yes, children, we were listening to speakers back then on cassette tapes. And he said, "I want you to go home. I want you to listen to this man." He says, "This is a tape of my sponsor. And if you still feel like killing people when you're all done listening to him, then I want you to call me. Because there are people at this fellowship I don't like. And I will help you." And that seemed reasonable to me. I am a nice little Catholic schoolgirl from the suburbs. I had never killed anybody. I figured I would need help. So, and I went home and I listened to this man, and the magic that is Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me that night. And that man has gone on to his reward. It was a man by the name of Johnny Harris. And it's very important that I say this next part because of the changes that are happening in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to hear what I'm about to say because this is very important. I had nothing in common with Johnny. Nothing. Different gender, different age group, different education level. Everything about this man was different from me, except he was bodily and mentally different from his fellows, and that's what he shared. He said every single time somebody told him his problem was drugs and alcohol, he always wanted to grab them around the throat and say, "Don't you get it? My problem is not drugs and alcohol. My problem is I don't have any alcohol right now. And I have to listen to you." And a light went on for me. It's like suddenly I got it. I got it. I got what was wrong with me. I was sober. I was as physically sober right then, listening to him, as I am right now, over 30 years later. I couldn't get any more sober. I am sober. You are sober. You're done. You're sober. All the people that picked up chips tonight, you are physically sober. That part's done. So now what? If you are like me, you're already starting to feel a little restless, a little irritated. These people are starting to annoy you. They're making suggestions like, you know, be sure you get a service commitment. You get a service commitment. What are you talking about? Get served. You do this. How many meetings are you going to? Did you call your sponsor this week? Are you doing this? And they're starting to just kind of bug you, right? That's alcoholism. That's alcoholism. Because, see, there's only one thing that's going to make that go away. There's only one thing that's going to make that me feel better. And that's alcohol. Unless I have a complete and total psychic change. And it's a lot more than just not drinking. It's a lot more than just getting into service. It's a lot more than just showing up on time. That's important. All those things are important. But these are my treatments, these 12 steps. And I don't know about anybody else in this room, but the reason I need a sponsor to walk me through these steps is because there's nothing particularly new or wonderful about these steps to me. You know, I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been given an amazing education by my family. I had been given a beautiful faith tradition that, by the way, I practice today. So if you have some sort of prejudice against it, tough. Talk to your sponsor. You know? And I saw the 12 steps, and there was nothing particularly about these, the philosophy of these steps that jumped out at me and made me go, oh my God, this is amazing. I've never seen this before. That's not true. I learned all of this stuff before I had to make my first Holy Communion when I was 7. And I remember thinking to myself, now what am I going to do? This didn't work before. Now what? But see, there's a magic that we have here at Alcoholics Anonymous that you're not going to get anywhere else. And it's summed up simply in the phrase, one alcoholic talking to another. See, Johnny didn't talk to me about my drinking. He shared with me about his. He shared what he felt when he was sober. And I went, oh my God, that's me. And he shared what happened to him when he drank. And I said, oh my God, that's me. And I picked up the phone and I called Kenny. And I said, you're not going to believe this, but I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, how long have you been hanging out with us? I said, about 2 years. He goes, you're a quick study. And I asked him what was probably the most important question I've ever asked anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous before. I said, would you be my sponsor? And Kenny outlined for me a program of sponsorship that only somebody who really wanted to be relieved of what I just heard somebody else describe would be willing to do. He says, we are going to work out of the big book. We are going to work out of the 12-12. Says, you are going to go where I go, and you are going to do what I do. Says, you are going to take the steps one at a time. And then you're going to take the traditions one at a time, and you're going to learn about them. Not just how to work them inside the rooms of AA, but outside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you are going to have a service commitment. You are going to have a sobriety date that you hold on to like a biting sow. And if at any time you get a better idea, that's fine. There's the door. Get yourself a new sponsor. No harm, no foul. And I said, okay. That's the miracle. That is the miracle. I turned my will and my life over to the care of some guy who had gone to prison in Louisiana. I turned my will and my life over the care of somebody who claimed to understand exactly how I felt because he too is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. You know, it's funny. I got all excited when they said they would read the long form of the corresponding month today because I knew what that meant. I knew we were going to read the long form of the third tradition. And I heard somebody over here, I'm not going to shame you, but somebody over here said, it's the same. No, it's not. I think one of the biggest disservices we do to newcomers in Alcoholics Anonymous is this short form of the third tradition. When we say the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And I'll tell you why I think that's a disservice. It's not because we're better. It's not that. It's because it would be the height of arrogance for me to think I can sponsor someone in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who does not suffer from alcoholism. And not everybody who has a desire to stop drinking suffers from alcoholism. And that's what open meetings are for. It's so that people that have been sent here because the heat is on, right? The judge has sent you here, your wife, your husband, your children, the community at large has told you, do something about what you're doing right now. You're raising havoc. But you don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, and you come to an open meeting to start hearing people like me tell you what it means to be an alcoholic. And what it means to be an alcoholic is described in the doctor's opinion. And for someone like me, is when I am stone cold sober, I am run by a thousand forms of fear. And it doesn't matter if that fear is purposeful or real. I'm run by it. I have to know where all the exits and entrances are. I don't drive 4.5 hours to stand up in front of a bunch of strangers and tell you my story. I get scared. I get afraid. That comes out as anger. That comes out as aggression. I have to push myself through things. I have to think. I'm always like this, and I'm in my head all the time. And I know you don't like me. I know what you're thinking. I know you think my hair's the wrong color, my butt's too big, and I'm not dressed right, and you don't like this, you don't like that, and you probably this, and that. And when I drink alcohol, something magic happens for me. Because that stuff goes down my throat and it hits my stomach and it goes pow. And it makes me real thirsty. And I get that second one and my shoulders come off my ears and I can take a deep breath. And by the third one, man, I can sing like Aretha and I can play pool like Minnesota Fats and I am the smartest person in the room. And why wouldn't I keep doing that? Now, yes, something else happens. A switch gets flipped. And I drink until. I drink until something stops me. Law enforcement. The end of somebody's fist. Coming to underneath people in a different state. I've never met these people before. Obviously, we're in a relationship. I didn't know that. You know. Something stops me. My brainstem becomes completely saturated and I end up in a hospital. But I have never, since my first drink of alcohol, said, thank you, that's enough for me. I've had enough. I should have a sandwich now and go home, you know. Now, people think that that means I'm being exclusive. Of course I'm being exclusive, because like I told you, there's almost 300 12-step programs in the United States alone, but there's only one for alcoholics, and that's this place. This is the only game in town for someone like me. Now, did I do other stuff? Duh. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, okay? When I was drunk, if someone put something in front of me and said, try this, I never went, why? What will that do? I just went, oh, okay. And you know, and then I would just sort it all out, right? And I'm going to tell you something really interesting. When I did my very first fourth and fifth step, what I figured out with my sponsor was that all the extra stuff I added to my alcohol mimicked my reaction to alcohol. And my reaction to alcohol is abnormal. Alcohol is a depressant. You know those friends we have that do things like they have two drinks and they go, oh God, that's enough, I'm gonna pass out. And we look at them like, what a lightweight you are, what's wrong with you, right? That apparently is a normal reaction to alcohol. It's a depressant. You have two and they go, oh, thanks enough for me. Oh, I better not have any more. I'm feeling it now. And I don't know about any of you, but that's never been what I have felt with alcohol. Never. In fact, the drugs I tried that made me feel like that, I don't do those. I don't do that. They're ridiculous. Why would I do that? And I've been thinking about that a lot in the last couple of months because, oh, somebody's phone ringing? Do we need to answer it? Okay. The reason is because I want to make sure that what I am doing when I am in a meeting and sharing for 2 to 3 minutes, or at a podium and sharing for 45, I want to make sure that what I am doing is offering to somebody in the room that is suffering from the disease of alcoholism an adequate presentation of the program of AA. Step number one for me impacted me in a way that was virtually, it was like getting hit in the face with a wet rag. You know, it was like sopping wet. And it happened that night that I heard Johnny Harris on that tape. Because all of a sudden I understood from listening to him that I had what he had. And I was absolutely powerless over alcohol. That when I wasn't drinking it, I was thinking about it. And when I was drinking it, I couldn't stop drinking it. And I would drink until, and then when I came to, I would say, I'm not going to do that again. And I would do it again. And it was not because I was a bad person. It was not because I have lacked moral fiber. It was not because I hated my parents. It was not because of any of that stuff. It was because I'm an alcoholic. And being sober hurts. And because of that, my life's unmanageable. And so now I've got to look at step two. Came to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. That's a big statement. First of all, I need to know what sanity means. You know, I thought when you guys talked about insanity that you meant all the goofy stuff we do when we're drunk. And I did a lot of goofy stuff when I was drunk. Seriously, I went home with people I didn't know. This was in the 70s and 80s. Let me put it this way. I turned 70 years old this last December, and one of my girlfriends from high school called me, and she goes, Leslie, you're the first one of us to turn 70. And I'm like, thanks for pointing that out, Carly. You know, I love you too. And she says, no, get this. We get to go through the 70s again. Says only there won't be nearly as many serial killers. And she's right. I was running the streets of San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York during a time that was quite interesting in terms of, you know, safety, right? I thought that's what you meant. And it's not. Do you know what being returned to sanity is for somebody like me? Is when the waitress says, would you like a cocktail? And I say, no thanks, I don't drink. That's it. Not, no thanks, I don't drink. You know why? I'm in AA, I've been sober for 33 years. I have a sponsor, her name's Debbie, she's over there. They don't care. They don't care, they just want your drink order, you know? So being able to say, no thanks, I don't drink. For someone like me, who couldn't not drink, because of the way I felt when I was sober, to be so changed that now I'm sober and I can say, no thanks, I don't drink. And then talk about the Giants. I'm watching you. I saw you. Just wait. That is sanity. That is being returned to sanity. And step two says that a power greater than me can restore me to that, that I can't do that. Thinking it through, playing through the tape, choosing the right action, doing the next right thing, I'm incapable of making myself sane. That's what that step says. And so now I'm looking at step three. I've got a decision to make. Because if I believe step two, that none of my hard work is going to make a difference other than it's going to get my butt in the chair of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's going to get me to my sponsor's house, it's going to have me make the phone calls I'm supposed to make, but I cannot restore myself to sanity, I have a decision to make. And you know what's interesting? My friend Mike out of Riverside pointed this out to me. Do you know that the word surrender is not in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? No. The first 164 pages, it's not in there. Now, it's in other parts of our literature, but it's not in there. That one that we all say, there's the program, it's not in there. But you know what we do say? We say we stood at the crossroads. We say we made a decision. We pray a prayer that says, God, I offer myself to thee. I offer myself. Do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of myself, that I may better do your will. Take from me my difficulties, my victory over them, may bear witness to those I could help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. I offer myself to that power that's going to restore me to sanity. And now I've got to get to work. And I start the writing. I do that inventory, a searching and fearless moral inventory. I look at the things I have done in my life to cause me injury, the things that other people have done in my life to cause me injury, the resentments I'm holding on to, the fears I've got, right? I get all of that down on paper. I look at the kind of relationships I've had and the mistakes I've made in those relationships, and I get it on paper. And then I sit down with someone and I admit to that God that's going to restore me to sanity and to that person everything that I've written down. But I'm going to tell you something. If I stop there, all I've got is a whole bunch of self-knowledge. Now, I may have a lot more self-knowledge than I had before, but that's all I got is self-knowledge. And what does self-knowledge avail us? Nothing. Nothing. Not a little bit. Nothing. So I've got to move into 6 and 7. I've got to. Or all I am is a self-aware alky that hasn't had a drink for a long time. I sit in meetings with a lot of those. Right? Usually they become drug and alcohol counselors. I'm just kidding. That's not just. I'm teasing. Anyway. But not really. Anyway. Six and seven allow me to look at the character defects that have literally driven me. And they allow me to say, do I trust this God that I've turned my will and my life over to? Do I trust this God with this person, me? Do I trust this God with all of me, good and bad? Will this God remove from me every single defect of character that is standing in the way of my usefulness to that God? Do I trust that? That's what 6 and 7 is asking of me. I sit down again and I put pen to paper. I look at that fourth step. Don't burn them. That's just an opinion. But don't burn them. You're going to need that list. And then you're going to keep making another one. Look at all the persons I've harmed. You know what my experience has become over the last 3 decades? You'll have to talk to other people that have been around longer than me and see if theirs is the same. We don't lose people at the 4th and 5th step. We lose people at steps 8 and 9. Because, man, that is when the rubber hits the road. And step 8 is tough, man. You've got to put pen to paper and look at the people you've harmed. And you have to put out of your mind what they did to you. And for some of us, that's damn hard. You know, I was having this wonderful conversation with John at dinner, and I have had the privilege of sponsoring 2 women. I sponsor them right now, that to me are just monuments to the resilience of the human spirit. These are women that literally have been through hell, one outside of AA, and it was the hell that got her into it, and one inside the rooms of AA, where she fell into the hands of a cult in Alcoholics Anonymous and a cult leader. And he's a dangerous, ugly man. I'd be happy to give you his name after the meeting. I won't put it on tape. And I always want to point out to people that the name of this organization is not Well-Adjusted People Anonymous. Okay? The way that one of the things that I say to them when we sat down to do their eight-step lists, we did it separately, and I've said this to any man or woman I have the privilege of sponsoring, is that I am never responsible for somebody else's criminal behavior. What I am responsible for is how I respond to that and when I'm going to take the responsibility to heal from it. I'm responsible for that. And I find that in my eighth step. In my ninth step, I sit down and I have this plan and I go over it with my sponsor and I say, I'd like to approach this person and say this. And what do you think? And they say, okay, well, let's tweak this. Let's do it this way, blah, blah, blah. And we come up with a plan. You know, my most favorite ninth step story is the one I made to my father. My father was our tornado. My father was 6'5", jet black hair, handsome. Oh, my God. He looked like a cross between Errol Flynn and John Wayne. And if you don't know who that is, Google it, all right? I don't want to talk to you. But handsome, man. And, oh, my God, he could charm the birds out of the tree. Big old Texas guy, right? But he was our tornado. He was amoral. He was violent. He was, my father was a World War II combat vet. And there's a real good chance that he was suffering from PTSD. But they didn't call it that back then, you know. And I was about a year and a half sober, and my father was diagnosed with cancer, and it was a really virulent cancer. He wasn't supposed to recover from it. And I'm sitting in meetings sobbing, oh, Dad's going to come. We don't have a good relationship. And my sponsor couldn't stand it anymore. And one day he just yanked me out and he goes, you are going to make your amends to your dad tonight. He says, I can't stand listening to you anymore. And so I grabbed together some of the money that I owed him and I wrote out what I was going to say. And I went up to the hospital and my father's in this special unit and he had a nurse staring at him 24 hours a day. And I walked up to him, and I said, Dad, I need to say something to you. And he's like, sure, honey. And I made my amends, and I put the money on the bed. I said, this is the first payment of money I owe you for all the money I've stolen from you over the years. And you know, I'm sorry about this, and blah, 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 and this is this, and blah, 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 blah. And he's like, honey, I've always loved you. And, you know, I didn't like you very much for a long time, but I've always loved you, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, oh, this is wonderful. And I'm walking out, and I hear the nurse say, oh, God, that was so beautiful. What is that? He says, I don't know. It's some goddamn hippie thing she's doing now. My father recovered from that cancer. And he and I had a really good relationship. And it was actually me. When my father died, I was the one who found his body because I was the only one of his three children that we know of that he had a good relationship with. And it was because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys gave me my father back. Now, my father never changed. Never. The last service commitment I gave my dad was after he died, when I made the victim impact statement at the sentencing of the young man he had gotten into a knife fight with at 3 o'clock in the morning in downtown Livermore on the way to his boat. He was 78 years old, getting in knife fights with people in downtown Livermore. And I was able to make the victim impact statement because Dad had already died. And I told that young man, you have a chance right now to turn your life around. Don't do to your children what my father did to his. And 2 years later, that kid walked up to me in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he had 18 months of continuous sobriety, and he thanked me. I don't know where he is now. I don't know if he's still sober, but I got to see that much. We were talking again before the meeting about the importance of steps 10 and 11. You know, I do not get into arguments with people about what part of the big book is step 10 and what part of the big book is step 11. I don't care. Okay? I don't care if you call this page step 10, this page step 11. I don't care if you call them steps 42 and a half. I don't care. When I sponsor the men and women I sponsor, we also work out of the 12 and 12. And the 12 and 12 gives some very specific instructions for doing step 10 and step 11. And what I have found is that I have never yet missed a nightly review or morning prayer and meditation in 33 years. I never miss it. Now, sometimes I'm very detailed with my nightly review. Other times it's, dear God, I didn't drink, I didn't use, I didn't homicide, I didn't suicide, everything's fine, I'll talk to you in the morning, good night, okay? But I always end my day with a review of my day. Because see, that little line in the book that we all misquote, it's not progress, not perfection, it's spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. If I am making spiritual progress, what am I making spiritual progress towards? Perfection. And I'm doing that knowing I'm never going to make it. That's humility. You know where I got that definition? From the 12 and 12. True humility is trying your best every morning to strive towards a perfect day, knowing you're not going to make it. Knowing that you're going to go at the end of that day, I could have done this a little better. I could have done that a little smoother. Tomorrow I'm going to give it another try. It's not about beating myself up. It's about looking honestly at Leslie and saying, tomorrow's another day. I have another chance tomorrow to be one of God's kids. And I'm going to take that chance and I'm going to do the best I can with it. About 5 years ago, a member of my faith tradition who absolutely adores Alcoholics Anonymous shared with me a prayer that is ancient in my faith tradition. It's been around for about 800 years. And it is like step 7 on steroids. And it is something I pray as part of my morning meditation every morning. If you're interested in hearing about it, I'd be happy to share it with you after the meeting. But I want to tell you, he shared it with me because of the immense respect he has for Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous can reach people like you in ways I can't. But once Alcoholics Anonymous reaches you, he says, I get to put my hand out, and if you take it, he says, you become my best friends. And I'm one of his best friends. All of this comes down to that what I need to have that's talked about in the doctor's opinion. That psychic change, that total moral psychology. Having had that spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, now I can go outside the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and I can pass for normal out there. I can have a life, thank you, that is second to none. I can go places and do things that I only could dream about before. I can meet calamity with serenity. I can do things if I keep on the firing line, if I keep doing this treatment program. I can incorporate the spiritual principles of the 12 traditions, and I can practice them in my daily life, in my relationships with other people. I can learn about the 12 concepts and the spiritual principles behind those concepts. And I can be a part of the mainstream of life. All because of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is amazing. I'm going to end with this. Last weekend, I was up in Oregon, in Salem, Oregon, with my current mentor. at a dog show. What? That's right. About 20 years ago, I decided what I really wanted to do, I wanted to become a Scottish Terrier breeder. And so I started learning about Scottish Terriers, how to do that. I had always owned Scotties. I've owned Scotties for about 40 years. But now this was going to be a whole different thing, right? And so 3 years ago, I got myself a little Scottie. I started showing her. She is halfway towards her championship. She wins things like she's winner's bitch. And that's not swearing. That's exactly what they say. It's like amazing. The first time I heard them say that, I thought, that's bad language. That's AKC. That's what they say. And last year, I bred her for the first time. And one of her puppies, little Emma, went back east and won the national sweepstakes for her age group. I did that, right? And I'm standing in the ring. Now, my dog isn't being shown, but they've been teaching me how to be a handler. And I'm standing in the ring with a six-month-old Manchester Terrier on the end of a lead. And this thing is hopping all around like this. And I'm standing there in front of the judge, you know, and we're trying to get the dog to stand. It's 6 months old. It doesn't know what it's doing. It's like, yay, I'm having a great time. And it's just having fun. And we finally get the dog to stand. And the dog does what it's supposed to. And the judge looks it over, and I carry it out. And I look across. And I look at all the rings filled with dogs and with all these people. And I thought to myself, seconds and inches. I could have missed this. Seconds and inches. If I had sat in rooms and just thought that the program was putting the plug in the jug and not drinking between meetings, I could have missed this. If I hadn't heard somebody describe alcoholism in a way that made me go, oh my God, that's me. I could have missed this. If I hadn't gotten a sponsor, if I hadn't taken these steps, if I hadn't had that total psychic change that allows me to walk out in the world as a woman of grace and dignity, I could have missed this. If you are an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, get one of us and say, help me, because we will. Because when we do that, we are helping ourselves. I want to thank Lee for asking me. I want to thank you all for listening. Most importantly, I want to thank you for my life. Thank you.
Give her one more, guys. That was awesome.